These are Buddhist monks in the city of Saigon, the capital of South Vietnam. It's a lovely city with broad boulevards, cafes chic with remembered Frenchness and pretty girls on bicycles. American soldiers there don't see its charm. Since 1961, almost 300 Americans have died in that country, and no one says that there won't be more. Saigon, temple bells and Buddhist monks in bright saffron robes who chant together in some unknown discipline. And beyond the city, unknown numbers of the Viet Cong raid and burn, and the end is not in sight. Viet Cong rebels, disciplined and well-supplied from bases in communist North Vietnam, have for years fought tenaciously and skillfully to overthrow the American-supported Saigon governments. The fighting is frequently at night, brief but vicious encounters in which one side tries to defend the hundreds of little villages scattered throughout the country, the other to capture, or failing this, to destroy. The war is relatively minor in its scope, but tremendous in potential. It is American guns against Russian and Chinese guns, a place where we and they confront each other with only a pretense in between. There have been five new governments since the beginning of the year. They changed nothing. A near showdown came this summer. On August 2nd, the USS destroyer Maddox was cruising in the waters of Tonkin Gulf, about 30 miles off the coast of North Vietnam. Three PT boats from North Vietnam approached the Maddox and attacked. The Maddox returned the fire. Four United States fighter planes joined in. The PT boats were driven off. 2 days later, the attackers tried it again. The Maddox and the Sea Turner Joy, another destroyer, hit back. It was a three-hour action in rough seas. 25 of the attacking patrol boats were hit. There was no damage to United States ships. The attacks ended.
And this year, on the little Mediterranean island of Cyprus, another brutal reminder that the world's affairs are in disorder. Archbishop Makarios, president of Cyprus, charged that some parts of the country's constitution inhibited progress and so should be struck out. The Turks on Cyprus, jealous of their liberty, objected. Vicious fighting broke out.
If they keep on shooting to this hospital, there'll be nothing. And if there is no place to keep the wounded ones, then we are all gone.
The island is too small for an easy war. United Nations troops were landed in March, and a kind of sullen order was restored. But horror, known intimately, is not quickly forgotten. A woman, a Turkish nurse, tried to define it.
I repeat and repeat that. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, we couldn't get our dead bodies, and we left them. We could have shot them down because the ambulance came right here. But our men didn't do that. Why? Because it was a wounded. And you don't shoot somebody which doesn't hold gun in her hand. You only shoot people which they hold gun.
And there was another voice this year, a calm voice, strong with courage.
The army is regrouping between us, somewhere between us and Stanleyville, and we will have to see what comes next.
It was in the Congo. The rebels who opposed the fragile leadership of Moise Tshombe overran a number of towns in the northeast. They captured some Europeans and a few Americans as they went. Here is Dr. Paul E. Carlson, an American missionary in the Congo.
They could take us out by river. But all is calm here, and we thank God for that.
He did not survive. In some monstrous proceedings, he was called a spy, and he died in a rebel-killing spree just minutes before rescue came. Belgian paratroopers flown in American planes landed at Stanleyville, the rebel capital, and took the town. They rescued hundreds, but for many it was too late. And in the Congo, as in Vietnam, the fighting goes on, and the night's dead are part of every morning, and there are children who no longer weep at killing.
They're battling for the championship of the world. They're battling shoulder to shoulder. They're not.
Tokyo outdid itself for the Olympics. The waiters learned English, or at least enough to comprehend the subtle difference between scrambled eggs and stewed corn. There were flags everywhere, nice places to stay, and for elated Americans, gold medals in swimming, basketball, and a gratifying number of track events. But the big one was the 10,000-meter run. This country had never won it before. 6 miles is a long run for any American, and here's how it ended.
Clark is taking him. No, Gamudi is saving off the challenge. Clark is sprinting. Gamudi is out in front by you. Here comes Mills of the USA! Mills of the USA! He won! He won! Followed by Gamudi and Clark. 28 minutes, 24 1/10 seconds. What a fantastic victory for the United States.
Professional football continued to draw big crowds and big money, but there were some changes. Y.A. Tittle of the New York Giants was out, and Johnny Unitas of the Baltimore Colts was in. And in baseball, Yogi Berra was in, out, and in again. He was picked to manage the Yankees, won the pennant, lost the series, and was promptly fired. Just as promptly, he was hired by the New York Mets. The significance of all this is a little difficult to say with certainty, and perhaps the best comment is to quote Yogi himself in a classic comment on the shadows in the Yankee Stadium outfield. It gets laid out there early.
Potatoes are cheaper, tomatoes are cheaper. Now's the time to...
There is, I suppose, a whole generation now to whom this voice is strange and unfamiliar. His name was Eddie Kent. He had big eyes, a brash voice, and an odd kind of appeal. In a business that is permissive and uncritical of personal laxity, he was austere and disciplined. He had a long apprenticeship in his craft, and indeed, his whole life was a process of learning how to be gay, how to be funny. In this, he was eminently successful. There were the vaudeville years, Broadway shows, Ziegfeld Follies, movies, and in the decade of the 30s, a radio show where he made fun of the Depression and told all of his old vaudeville jokes and sang this song.
If you capture your steady, just name the first Eddie. Now's the time to fall in love.
He died on October 10th in Hollywood of a coronary occlusion. He was 72.
And there was another this year, Gracie Allen of Burns and Allen.
Well, Gracie, say hello to everybody.
Hello, everybody. What do I do now?
Well, and there were others, of course.
Oh, all right.
Indian Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, student of Gandhi and Thoreau and British law, a leader of the Indian independence movement, inventor of a kind of aggressive neutrality. There was Lord Beaverbrook and Lady Astor, Alan Ladd and William Bendix, Cole Porter and Harpo Marx, and at the age of 84 and stubbornly after three operations, General of the Army Douglas MacArthur. He had been a man of many controversies. This much was beyond dispute. He fought as well as any general this country has ever known. And in his speeches, he topped them all.
I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.
And at the age of 90, Herbert Clark Hoover, 31st President of the United States. He was president when the Depression came and suffered the penalty that all pay who are in the wrong place at the wrong time. He knew vindication of a sort, at least in his later years, and it must have given him satisfaction and solace. His memories were long and deep.
I was taken from this village to the far west 78 years ago. The only material assets which I had were two dimes in my pocket, the suit of clothes that I wore, and I had some extra underpinnings provided by loving aunts. But I carried from here something much more precious. I had a stern grounding of religious faith. I carried with me recollections of a joyous childhood where the winter snow...
And it's a measure of his greatness that his personal memories were part of the folk memories of the land.
This was not a memorable year in the arts. There were still seven of them, and they were still reasonably lively, but there was no single book or play that overshadowed all others.
The most significant book of 1964 was, in a sense, not a book at all. It was a report, the published findings of the Warren Commission after 10 months of hearings into the assassination of President John Kennedy. In this country, but more especially in Europe, there were those who said that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting in concert with others, that there were power groups, foreign and domestic, who impelled him to his act. The commission said that this was not so, and Texas Governor John Connally, who was wounded when the president died, thought it might stem the rumors.
If you will recall, there were a great many reports, rumors, rampant throughout this country, and particularly all over Europe, that this was the result of a conspiracy. I have never felt that it was. The commission finds that it was not. And I think this will have a particularly salutary effect throughout the country, throughout the free world.
And in Dallas, Texas, on March 14th, some unfinished business was completed. The jury, deliberating the guilt or innocence of Jack Ruby, the killer of Oswald, announced that they had reached a verdict. Judge Joel B. Brown, following custom, repeated the verdict and the sentence.
We, the jury, find the defendant guilty of murder with malice as charged in the indictment and assess his punishment at death. Signed, Max E. Causey, Foreman. So say you all, ladies and gentlemen. Is that your unanimous verdict? All right, Sheriff, he's your prisoner.
May I thank the jury?
The sentence, by the way, was appealed, and that, too, was proper. But most of us wanted only to get on to other things.
Hello!
Let's thank my lucky star.
On Broadway, musicals predominated again with David Merrick's Hello, Dolly, the biggest hit. Carol Channing's singing of the title song became the biggest political sound of the year with new lyrics.
Hello, Mr. President. This is Carol, Mr. President. Carol Channing, come to sing a song for you. Hello, Lyndon. Well, hello, Lyndon. We'd be proud to have you back where you belong.
The Democrats already had their president. There would be no midnight compromises, no smoke-filled rooms, none of the drama of a roll call. Their problem at the convention was to jazz it up, and they did it fairly well.
The band playing, and the folks saying that the people know that you've got so much more. So flash that smile, Lyndon. Show us that winning style, Lyndon. Promise you'll stay with us in 64.
The leading candidate for vice president was Hubert H. Humphrey, the liberal senator from Minnesota. The president might have announced his choice months before the convention, but Mr. Johnson held off his announcement, and there was a certain tension among newsmen. Even Humphrey himself was not entirely sure. It was a good example of how suspense can create interest. People who run beauty contests have used the same technique for years. President Johnson played it as far as he could. Governor Pat Brown of California, maybe, or New York's Mayor Wagner. When he finally tipped his hand, you could almost forget that the issue had never really been an issue at all.
I hope that you will choose, as the next Vice President of the United States, my close, my long time, My trusted colleague, Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota.
Mr. Humphrey, like Mr. Johnson, is supremely professional. And when they run a show, it's professional too. Here is Hubert Humphrey in top form. The subject of his remarks, the record of Barry Goldwater, Senator from Arizona.
Most Democrats and Republicans in the Senate voted for an $11.5 billion tax cut for American citizens and American business, but not Senator Goldwater. Most Democrats and Republicans in the Senate voted for the National Defense Education Act, but not the temporary. And my fellow Americans, most Democrats and most Republicans in the Senate voted to help the United Nations in its peacekeeping functions when it was in financial difficulty, but not Senator Goldwater.
You could almost forget at times that the key figure was not there at all. Almost, but not quite.
Mr. Chairman.
Sometimes he seemed to fill the room. He was a giant, of course, and taller in depth than most men are in life. His voice was not heard. But for one almost shocking moment, it seemed to be the same inflection, the same broad A. Robert Kennedy spoke of his brother. And the applause that came 16 minutes in an eerie, spontaneous ovation was a tribute not for the living, but for the dead.
I wish to speak just for a few moments. I first want to thank all of you, as delegates to the Democratic National Convention and the supporters of the Democratic Party, for all that you did for President John F. Kennedy. And when there were difficulties, you sustained him. When there were periods of crisis, you stood beside him. When there were periods of happiness, you laughed with him. And when there were periods of sorrow, you comforted him. I realize that as an individual, that we can't just look back, that we must look forward. When I think of President Kennedy, I think of what Shakespeare said in Romeo and Juliet, when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun.
It is not easy to walk in another man's footsteps. In his acceptance speech, President Johnson made it clear he wanted to go his own way.
Our problems are many and are great, but our opportunities are even greater. And let me make this clear. I ask the American people for a mandate not to preside over a finished program, not just to keep things going. I ask the American people for a mandate to begin.
Certainly one of the most significant political decisions of 1964 was made by the Democratic Convention, the creation of a permanent committee to help in the registration of Negroes in Mississippi and to see to it that they may participate without hindrance at every level of the Democratic Party in that state.
We were promised this time that the American people would be offered a choice and not an echo. This was to be a debate about basic principles. And what do we hear? We hear not philosophy, but mudslinging. Not ideas, but smears and scandal. Not programs, but the old worn-out slogans of an old worn-out effort written by the same old worn-out man trying to frighten the American people.
Across the country, we began to choose up sides.
The election campaign was hectic, reasonably true to form, and much, much too long.
Well, I don't think you're going to let it work, are you? I think I can tell you why they're doing it. They found out that the American people...
Because I'm not sure they know what they're doing. But it's a fact that Johnson and his curious crew...
Goldwater attacked Johnson and Humphrey. Humphrey attacked Goldwater and ignored Miller. Miller concentrated on Humphrey, and Johnson blandly insisted he wasn't campaigning at all.
Seemed to believe that progress in this country is best served simply and directly through the ever-expanding gift power of the everlastingly growing federal government. Now, one thing we all know, and I assure you I do...
What is at issue here is not Mr. Goldwater's private life, but rather his public role, his public posture in American politics. He's a decent citizen. He's loyal. He's patriotic. I think he'd make a good neighbor. But clearly, he's unqualified to be president of the United States.
I am telling you, ladies and gentlemen, that that this war in South Vietnam is never going to be ended, and it's never going to be won until Barry Goldwater is president of the United States of America.
Johnson won easily. The Republicans picked up one governor's chair, and a few of the senators and congressmen who had declined to support Goldwater survived the great Johnson landslide. But it was slim comfort. Governor Romney of Michigan kept his seat, thus moving into the front ranks of the battered GOP leadership. Former White House press secretary, newly appointed Senator Pierre Salinger, failed in his re-election bid in a close race with one-time movie star George Murphy. Robert Kennedy beat the veteran Kenneth Keating and joined his brother Ted in the United States Senate. The Democratic sweep was massive. The Republicans didn't just lose, they were shattered. Only Mr. Goldwater himself seemed to find some solace. After the returns were in, and a little later than customary, he made his concession, an appearance that did not sound quite so much an admission of failure as a call to battle.
I have no bitterness, no rancor at all. I say to the president, as a fellow politician, that he did a wonderful job. He put together a vote total that's larger than has ever been gained in this country. This effort that we engaged in last January the 3rd turns out to be a much longer effort than we thought. It's not an effort that we can drop now, nor do we have any intentions of dropping it now.
In Britain, in a campaign a great deal shorter than ours and so restrained it occasionally took on all the excitement of a literary debate, Sir Alec Douglas Hume was defeated as Prime Minister, Harold Wilson was in, and in Commons there was a tiny Labour majority. And that same week, this.
Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, speaking by radio to three Russian cosmonauts circling the Earth in a spaceship. From Moscow, the following day, this.
It was announced in Moscow that Leonid Brezhnev has been elected first secretary of the Soviet Communist Party's Central Committee. Alexei Kosygin has been appointed chairman of the USSR Council of Ministers. Both the Central Committee plenum and the session of the parliament's presidium satisfied Nikita Khrushchev's request to relieve him from the duties of first secretary of the party's Central Committee. As member of the Central Committee's presidium and chairman of the USSR Council of Ministers.
It took a couple of days, but Radio Moscow finally explained why.
To hair-brained planning, half-baked conclusions and hasty decisions, and actions divorced from reality, bragging.
Communist China's Radio Peking had a different idea about Khrushchev's sins.
Communist construction. He tried in 1,001 ways to switch back to the old path of capitalism, the world's first socialist state, which the Soviet people, under the leadership of Lenin and Stalin, had created by their sweat and blood.
And that same week, Communist China made some startling and frightening news of its own.
The Chinese nuclear device was exploded at a test site near a lake called Lopnor in the Taklamakan Desert of the remote Central Asian province, Sinkiang. Nuclear spread is dangerous to all mankind. The lesson of Lopnor is that we are right to recognize the danger of nuclear spread, that we must continue to work against it, and we will.
After contemplation, I conclude that this award, which I receive on behalf of that movement, is a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time.
Martin Luther King, winner of the 1964 Prize for Peace. The year had been a busy one for him, and he lived this year intimately with violence.
We must honestly confess that it will be difficult to get a conviction, but I'm always open to creative surprises, and I would certainly hope that Mississippi will surprise the nation and the world in this instance.
He was talking about the 21 persons in and around Philadelphia, Mississippi, who were arrested in connection with the murder last summer of three civil rights workers. The indictments, based on federal statutes, were thrown out by a local judge. In the eyes of the Justice Department, at least, the case remained open. This signal comes from Mariner 4, a United States space vehicle that at year's end was on its way to the planet Mars. It's a 335 million mile trip. If things go right, it will send back television pictures of the surface of the planet.
And on the last day of July, in an act of almost unbelievable virtuosity, American scientists sent a rocket full of television cameras to the moon. Excellent pictures were sent back. The moments just before the impact were magnificent, and even for the busy scientists and engineers in the tracking room, tense and dramatic.
10 seconds. Excellent signal strength. We're receiving pictures to the end. Impact has occurred. Impact has occurred. We receive pictures to impact. There was no interruption in the transmission from all cameras on the spacecraft.
The year's end was strangely like the year's beginning. There was some improvement. In Panama, there were beginning talks for a new treaty to ease matters in the canal zone and leading possibly to a new canal across the isthmus. Russia seemed a little less remote after the announcement that a profit-making scheme would now apply to the heavy as well as light industries. But new angry voices were raised against us in the United Nations, voices from new African countries thought to be our friends. And even more hurtful somehow, there was growing resentment against us in the Philippines. And new leaders were emerging in South Vietnam who were complaining openly about American interference.
The riots made the big sounds this year and the wars and agitated people, young and old.
It is a commonplace that those events that make the loudest noise are the ones that seem the most important. Maybe they are for a day or so, but not for all time.
These are sounds from space, from beyond our solar system. It sounds like any static. The universe is full of it. But for some, at least, this sound is particularly curious. There are now operating several devices designed to catch and listen to signals from space. Most of the sound is cosmic static. But here, dimly heard and subtle, is a sound that might have a pattern to it.
Many sounds and voices competed for our listening this year. This was the softest of them all. Yet all could fade under this sound. And we might remember this year as the year we first heard this sound, this potential pulse, heard, and in the act of pondering a response, outgrew the world.